A grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, offering pinch-proof doors, keyless digital entries, and lifetime manufacturer's warranties. Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families with professionally installed doors and automatic openers since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL Urbana, AM 580 and online at WILL.UIUC.edu. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for tuning in. If you're a fan of the outdoors and enjoy walking, bird watching, or canoeing, biking, I hope you'll stay tuned for this portion of the program. Our guest this afternoon, Joel Greenberg. He's a naturalist, lawyer, and writer, and he's written a natural history of the 19 counties of the Chicago region of Illinois, Wisconsin, Indiana, and Michigan. The title, A Natural History of the Chicago Region. The book tells the story of the region's prairies, wetlands, and forests, its lakes, rivers, and streams, and its wildlife, including insects, birds, reptiles, and mammals. Greenberg also looks at the forces that shape the landscape and its soils, as well as the impact people have had on the region. Listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon. Join the discussion with a telephone call. I look forward to your questions and comments. If you're listening in the Champaign-Urbana area, the number is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. In addition to A Natural History of the Chicago Region, Joel Greenberg is the co-author of A Birder's Guide to the Chicago Region. He is co-author for that book, published by Northern Illinois University Press, Lynn Carpenter. A Natural History of the Chicago Region is published by the University of Chicago Press. 333-9455, 800-222-9455. Joel Greenberg, thank you so much for joining me this afternoon.
Well, thank you very much for having me on the show. I appreciate it greatly.
Yeah. This obviously was a labor of love.
It was. It took 17 years from the time I started, which consisted of my mother and I going to the Chicago Historical Society on Saturdays, and it started in the fall of 1983, and it was published in June of 2002. So it did take quite a while.
Well, thank you. It's a wonderful book.
Well, thank you for saying that.
Sure. When and how did your appreciation of the environment begin?
Well, I was always interested in animals, and I had a butterfly phase when I was, maybe 9 or 10. And then about the age of 12, I became an avid birder, and so that really was sort of a dominant theme in my life. And, every college I picked, on the basis of where I could see birds, for example. And so it was pretty central. And as time went on, there's two issues. One is, my interest broadened to include other kinds of critters and plants. And in addition, just in the few years that I've been around, you could see changes. Places that you used to go birding, places where I saw lifers, which in birding parlance means the first time you've seen a bird. One example is a bobolink, which lives in grasslands, and my lifer bobolink is now a school in the middle of suburbia of Northbrook. So I could even see those changes, and I've always been interested in history, so I would read the old bird books, and some of the stuff just kind of gives me goose pimples, when you read about passenger pigeons or prairie chickens and the like. So those were some of the antecedents, really, to my deciding to do this book.
Yeah. You close the book with a look at where we are and what lies ahead, and you suggest we go gentle into that good fight, the fight for preservation and restoration. And you begin with something that surprised me, as it did you. It is possible, perhaps probable, that as many as 90% of all the organisms that ever inhabited the region survive in it. Then comes the sobering news, though. Their numbers are greatly reduced. What's your sense of the ecological health of the region?
Well, and there's different ways, again, to look at it. I mean, there's so little of the surface of the land that's still in a natural state. Our waters, and I've learned this since the book came out, I've been more doing work on aquatic systems. Those are really imperiled. And, I mean, for example, it's research all over the country shows that if as little, and this is really not much less, if as little as 10% of a watershed, of course, watershed's the land that drains into a given waterway, has an impermeable surface. So that means if at least 10% is covered with cement in some way, streets, you start to lose the most conservative species. So, you know, you could save a prairie by buying it and managing it, but in order to save some of these higher quality streams that we still have, the amount of land you'd have to buy to save it is really pretty tremendous. So it's sort of mixed. I mean, I'm, you know, looking at that, I'm pessimistic. Something that makes me very optimistic or, you know, something that's a good thing is that there are these huge tracts, the Madewin, which is kind of down your way in our southwest part of our region, is 19,000 acres of land that used to be an Army arsenal. And that 19,000 acres is close to a state park and it's close to some forest preserve land. So there's over 20,000 acres of land being managed for nature. There's some other examples. I mean, the Indiana Dunes, there's 12,000 acres. Cook County Forest Preserve, and Cook County, you know, the most populated county in the state, there's 67,000 acres of preserved land, and that's pretty remarkable. And so there's sort of mixed. You know, development continues. People are trying to figure out ways how to do smart growth. Their success is mixed. Illinois has more governmental entities than any other state in the country, which means that it's very hard to get comprehensive planning, roads, subdivisions, commercial, industrial. So in the long term, there will be, it's probably going to be, you know, mixed.
Yeah. A number of years ago, I spoke with a couple of people who were involved in the restoration of what was the Joliet Arsenal. Such an ambitious project. How is it going? What can you tell us about the progress there?
Well, I'm not sure I know, like, up to the minute, but this was a clear case. Well, let me say something. That, you know, in terms of conservation, some of the people that have done the most but are the most unheralded are people that work in government. You know, not-for-profit groups need to trumpet themselves in order to get donations. Politicians need to trumpet themselves, but it's the staffers. And frankly, Madewin became what it is because of a handful of government employees. And so it was a very carefully thought out, coordinated effort, and I mean they brought in not-for-profits too. So the just that it's saved is itself a pretty amazing thing. But to answer more directly your question, there's an ongoing planning process. I mean, I think you know, much of it was closed to the public, and I'm not sure if they're planning on opening it or have opened part of it. You know, there's still conflicting. There's people that want to do more hunting and people that want to do different things. And I know it's in good hands. I mean, in this process, I think people agree is a pretty good one. So I'm, you know, and I think the other thing that is important, so you have this 19,000 acres, and one of the things that have long attracted conservationists were the populations of two species of birds in particular. One is called the upland sandpiper, and it has the largest population in Illinois, if not the upper Midwest, and loggerhead shrikes. Well, if you were to turn the whole site, say, into tall grass prairie, you would lose a lot of those two, those two species would decline. They've done well because the land's part of the area has been grazed. And so the point is that you have to be real careful with how you manage it to ensure that you maximize the diversity of it. So, you know, some grazing's probably good. Some parts of it you want to turn into to prairie. There's some wooded savanna areas. There are areas that probably need to have, well, need for political reasons, more intensive use. So it's big enough, and I think maybe that's the key that I really ought to end with on this subject, is the key is it's big enough where you can accommodate the needs of the variety of organisms as well as big enough to accommodate the varying human needs. And that's an important point. We need huge sites in order to do both of those things.
Yeah. Well, I think I'm going to have to do a show on that effort there in the Joliet area. But in the meantime, let's mention this one more time. Midewin, I really like this. It's an Indian word for healing.
I'm sorry?
The word, the prairie, the Midewin National Tallgrass Prairie, Midewin means healing. Potawatomi word for healing.
Correct. When they decided that they, I mean, the Joliet Army Arsenal Tallgrass Prairie just didn't sound right. So I mean, they looked and trying to, you know, further effort to try to hook, to connect this natural area with a human, you know, historical cultural component, and that's an important thing we could talk about maybe later is that connection between people and nature in such an urbanized area. But here's a case where, you know, they're looking at the positive elements of that.
Yeah. Well, now let's go back in time to the arrival of the first Europeans to the region. And the changes to the landscape happen relatively rapidly, I would say. And one of the epigraphs to the chapter on settlement that you begin, chapter 3, in Quality Diminished Prairie Settlement and Conservation.
Could I ask you to speak up a little bit?
Sure, I'm sorry. Maybe
I'm
we
sorry.
Could let me ask my director too to boost the level.
Okay, thank you very much.
Sure. The chapter on prairie settlement and conservation, that chapter begins with a couple of epigraphs, and one of them comes from Charles Holden, writing in 1882. And here we're going back to the arrival of the first Europeans. Well, by 1882, Europeans had been here for a while, but by 1882, the landscape, the changes to the landscape were apparent. And Charles Holden here in 1882 is remarking on them. How do his words contrast with the accounts of the French who arrived 100 years earlier? And maybe what I should do is share this epigraph from the chapter on prairie settlement. The vast prairie which lay before them in 1836, now they could scarcely recognize. Indeed, there seemed to be no trace of the original country left, so great had been the changes.
The prairie areas, and that was, I mean, the French wrote about it in almost biblical terms. The beauty of it. I mean, I quote one scholar, a woman named Dondori, who looked at the French chronicles, and she concluded that they use these superlatives almost beyond volition. I mean that, and she said that for them they were in land land unsurpassed, something to that effect, and. Now, everybody didn't like prairies when they first saw them, but one thing that we need to keep in mind, too, is that although the French arrived in 1673, there was much of the 1700s and until the 1830s, there wasn't a lot of settlement because the Native Americans didn't want it, and so there was the Fort Dearborn Massacre, and then there was the Black Hawk revolt. And so it wasn't until the 1830s with treaties and the Indians agreeing to move west that the settlers came in. And they found the prairies really pretty daunting. They were areas deemed to be sickly. One scholar, a medical historian, said that Illinois was known as a graveyard state because of malaria. The lack of trees, some of that was sort of a prejudice. You looked at land and said no trees. Obviously, it's pretty infertile. But there were practical reasons, because you needed wood to build your tools, to make your house. Much of the area was low, and so water wasn't necessarily very, very good. And furthermore, if you did try to settle, and it was very difficult to break through this incredibly dense sod, thousands of years of intertwined roots and grasses, meant that you had to hire special plows that had maybe 20 to 30 oxen, and that was quite expensive. Well, it really wasn't until the development of the steel plow that enabled the smaller farmer to do some of this himself that the prairie was conquered. And you're right, what's really striking is, I mean, 1840 to me was a critical period. That was a period where there was still wilderness. I mean, some of the, you know, there were probably still mountain lions and wolves, some of the whooping cranes. I mean, some of these big fauna, the large fauna that didn't survive very long, they were still there in the beginning. But in the 1840s, people poured in, and from 1840 maybe to the end of the 1800s, maybe 50, 60 years, the prairie went from being, or in the case of Holden, I mean, he's writing in the 1880s near Joliet, so maybe it was even less, maybe 40 years, it went from being what was probably the dominant landscape in most of this area to being virtually gone. And I mean, it was incredibly rich land. And so and people didn't really see the value of it, the conservation efforts didn't seriously start until the 1960s. But fortunately, there were, largely because of certain kinds of land uses, little bits of it did survive. And starting really, well, I mean, it started in the 1920s when Professor Sampson at U of I wrote to county commissioners asking them if they could tell him if there were any, didn't call them prairies, but certain kinds of grasslands. And he discovered there were some left, and then there was a systematic effort in the 60s. So you're right, it disappeared in a hurry, which really wasn't lamented until most of it was gone.
Yeah. It's interesting to think about where it survived. One of the places it survived, cemeteries.
When the pioneers set aside little bits of land to bury their dead, a few of those have survived. And there are a couple. There's one in Will County called Vermont Cemetery. There's one in northern Indiana called German Methodist. And you can even see, it's interesting, it actually rises. These cemeteries with the intact soils actually rise a little bit, almost like kind of an island, above the land that's been farmed for so long. Just relate a little experience. About a year or two ago, I was with Bob Betts, and Bob Betts is probably the prairie guru of northern Illinois. He's studied it. He's tried to preserve it. His students have gone on to be active in the prairie conservation movement. And I was with him at Vermont Cemetery, and we're standing there in late summer. This is, again, in Will County, one of the fastest growing counties in the country. And there are these gravestones, dated 1840, and we're looking at prairie gentian, which is one of those species that needs just absolute pristine environment. And right near us, I mean, it's surrounded by fields, and there's a tractor doing its thing, and then just beyond the tractor are all these subdivisions, like a big wave coming up a beach. So you can, it was really a striking vignette of just standing there and seeing hundreds of years of Illinois and then the future. So you can occasionally hit these magic moments where you can just see 200 years of Illinois.
Yeah. Tell us about Goose Lake Prairie. Where is it? How did it survive?
Goose Lake Prairie is in Grundy County. well, from Chicago, you take 55 and you get off at Lorenzo Road. It's a state park, and it survived for a few reasons. First of all, it was grazed, so it wasn't the highest quality prairie in the sense of being undisturbed, but much of it was low so that it was wet. It was also littered with glacial erratics, and that term refers to giant rocks that were deposited by the glaciers. It was owned by a family that might have had something to do with it, people who were satisfied with grazing it. So you had so those were probably the principal reasons why it was never plowed. I mean, there may have been sections of it that were, but it was a big enough site. It was sort of a matrix of really high quality with lesser. But what really, you know, attracted people, what made it clear that this was something that needed to be preserved, was the size of it. And anybody, I would recommend people going, because what's really striking, it's not the most colorful prairie, but it's of landscape scale. So there's low areas, there's a little slough with marshes and open water. There's henslow sparrows. There's pretty much a full complement of grassland birds. I was there about a month ago, and we're standing there, and you know, there's an American bittern that's flying, and the sora rail is feeding on the edge of the marsh, and even a bald eagle flew over. I'm not sure what he was doing there, but so it's you know, it's largely the size. It's supposed to be the largest prairie, really east of the Mississippi. Madewin, see, has little bits of prairie, but it's much smaller. So Madewin, the thing that's so important about it is size, for the reasons I said. But in Goose Lake, which is a little smaller, but Goose Lake was less disturbed. And then, I mean, if there's a continuum, you can go to some of the smaller prairies. One of my favorite, for example, is Markham Prairie. I was there just 2 days ago, and it's stunning right now. I mean, Celeste, I invite you to come up to Markham this weekend and see acres of blazing stars. I mean, just like a sea of purple. So that's very high quality. That's never really been messed with very, very much. But, it's smaller. I don't know, 90 acres. So it's, in some ways, there's certain things that it will never have. But at least the insects and plants that are there are pretty intact.
Yeah. Now, if I was to come up and visit Markham Prairie, could I visit this prairie spot without disturbing it?
Yes. Markham has there's a series of trails. I mean, I should say, and maybe this is one time somebody did it. I mean, but that does illustrate a point, too, is that we've got some neat things here in northern Illinois. I mean, we don't have redwood trees and we don't have grizzly bears, but you know, we have orchids and blazing stars, and there is that fine line that you want to share this information. You want people to know that it's worth fighting to save these things. But some of the plants are vulnerable. There's a federally endangered species called the prairie fringed orchid, and there are several populations scattered around. And I was told that one site in Lake County, Illinois, in fact, it's a forest preserve land, somebody stole 7 or 8 of these orchids. So, you know, there's a part of me that says I'd love people to see these things, and yet, because they are smaller, the sites themselves are smaller, you know, you have to be a little circumspect in, divulging or really encouraging people to see them. I mean, I think Markham's fine. I mean, there's a broad, it's not that heavily trafficked. There's some nice trails, but I'd encourage you to stay on the trail if you went there.
Yeah, I would do that.
Okay.
I would do that. And I wouldn't take any plants either. That breaks my heart. That breaks my heart. Let's talk with a listener. Caller in Urbana on line 1. Good afternoon.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. Well, I just dialed and called. I would like to talk to Mr. Greenberg. When he mentioned Goose Lake Prairie, that brought back a wonderful, wonderful. Well, I picked up the Sunday paper on Monday morning. My husband and I was dean of engineering, and we were naturalists and so on and so on. But anyway, I said, Ross, listen to this. I said, they're having a special meeting. Mr. Rutherford, the state naturalist representative, I don't know which.
Well, Bill Rutherford was the Governor Ogilvie had just recently appointed him to head the what was then known as the Department of Conservation.
Yes, and I'm glad to know he's still alive because I'm now 86, and I was probably about 56 when maybe 60. I don't know, but anyway, so I read that to my husband that they were going to have a meeting that Monday morning. I was reading Sunday's paper Monday morning at breakfast time, and I said, listen to this. They're going to have a meeting with Mr. Rutherford on LaSalle Street at, I've forgotten office, and talking about Goose Lake Prairie. They had to cancel the one they had in May or June, but anyway. And I said, the lady who owns the land wants to sell it, and there's a big company that wants it. Big manufacturing company, and Rutherford, of course, wanted it for the state of Illinois. Well, so did I and all the nature organizations to which I belong. I got on the phone here in Urbana. I called our head of Nature Conservancy, and I called another nature group and another nature group. And to each one, I told them what I've just told you, and I said, they're going to have that meeting at 11 o'clock. And Mr. Rutherford's going to be there again, and so are the people from this big factory, whatever. And I said, everybody call three people and have them send telegrams. No, 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 it's for the state of Illinois. And I called my daughter on the faculty of University of Wisconsin, and she told her professors and friends. And anyway, it happened, I heard later, well, I called garden clubs and everything. I spent the whole morning and get that telegram. Of course, there isn't any Western Union anymore. But they had to be ankle-deep in telegrams that's supposed to go to the state of Illinois, according to all park and nature lovers and these telegrams. And Rutherford got it by about 1 or 2 or 3 in the afternoon.
Well, that's great because it was it was a close vote, and Bob Beck says that was really the turning point. I mean, the state committed a lot of money to buying prairie, and really, you know, most of the lands that had been preserved up to then were forested lands, and so the battle for Goose Lake not only saved this incredibly valuable piece of land, but also set a tone that enabled other people to go out and preserve more prairie land. So what you did was a good thing.
Well, and when my husband, who, as I said, a professor and then eventually became dean of engineering research and development, and he said to me, oh, yeah, save that because they don't need any more industry up there on that river. So, well, you can tell how I'm blah, 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 blah.
have you been there since it's been saved?
Yes, yes, yes. Well, years ago.
Uh-huh.
Since then, my husband has deceased before he retired. But I'm 86 and still alive and pushing for trees and birds and
well, good for
prairie.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. You know, this caller reminds me of some of the people that, Joel Greenberg, that you write about in the book, A Natural History of the Chicago Region. People who said, darn it, we got to save this. When it comes to the Hoosier Prairie, there was a woman by the name of Irene Herlocker.
Uh-huh.
And she was a gal in a white hat, wasn't she?
She was, and I mean, I've met Irene since. I mean, I didn't know her when I wrote the book, but I've met her since, and she's still, you know, is quite active and goes out and works hard for the prairie. That's one of the things that does become clear. In order to save these things, you know, I mean, what Hillary Clinton said, it takes a village to raise a child. Well, I mean, it takes a village to save these sites. You know, it helps to have people approaching it from all different directions. I mean, Irene turned out that one of her high school friends became a state senator. So when she learned about Hoosier Prairie and it was close to where she grew up, she was, you know, in a position to call this person and tell them about it, And also, it's clear that, you know, when this stuff gets in your gut, and it, you, the word love, I mean, is totally appropriate. I mean, people, you can really become committed to these things, and that shows. I mean, you're talking to a senator that you used to know, and your enthusiasm for it and honesty. So, you know, and she in turn relied on, you know, help, Dr. Betts for technical expertise. And so, yeah, I mean, it really takes a full panoply of resources to save these things. And the one other thing I want to say is conservationists can win a million battles, and you only have to lose one to lose your sight. So it takes constant vigilance.
Yeah, and her campaign was 9 years long, 9 years in the running.
Well, and that's not even the longest. I mean, there's another site that I write about that's interesting in its own right, and that's called Wolf Road Prairie in Westchester, Illinois, which is in Cook County, a western suburb. And, I mean, I think the battle for that, and it's still going on because they, you know, focused on 80 acres of prairie, and they ranged, in fact, the state treasurer now, but was state senator then, I think, Judy Bartopinko was instrumental in getting Cook County and the state to agree to split this 80 acres, that they would each buy, you know, roughly half of it. And so, and there was Valerie Spale was the Irene Herlocker of Goose Lake of Wolf Road Prairie. And so, with Valerie's kind of pushing and prodding, and you know, and again, Senator Topinko was supportive, and they were, and so once they bought the 80 acres, they started looking to buy the land around it again. I mean, it's real clear that the more land around a site, I mean, you can protect it better. And so I think they're still trying to acquire parcels here and there, so that's maybe even a longer fight.
Mm. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon is Joel Greenberg. He's a naturalist, a writer, and a lawyer, and he's written a natural history of the 19 counties of the Chicago region of Illinois, Wisconsin, Indiana, and Michigan. The title, A Natural History of the Chicago Region. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, I invite you to join the discussion this afternoon. Your questions and comments are invited. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Have forests fared better in Illinois and the Chicago region than prairie?
Yeah, I mean, I think so for probably a couple reasons, but there's maybe two ways to look at that. Certainly, more of it was protected. In part, people value trees and people value forests, whereas appreciation of prairies was relatively recent. Also, the Cook County Forest Reserve District, which I mentioned before, was created in 1913, and DuPage County Forest Reserve, for example, was created in 1915. And they focused on wooded areas. So if you think about Cook County, I mean, the woods around here were largely along rivers, particularly, you know, we have predominantly westerly winds, and they carried the fires, so they went from west to east. So on the east sides of rivers, there would be forests that wouldn't be burned, and you'd find forests in morainal areas. Moraines is uplands created by land that the glaciers deposited, and fires weren't able to get into ravines. So if you look around, I mean, for example, there's the Palos area, which is a beautiful part of western Cook County. There's 15,000 acres of that has been preserved. So the point is that early on, there was an effort to target forested areas along riparian areas and these uplands to save them. So to that extent, probably more of that land was preserved. Now, subsequently, and this sort of opens up another big area we could talk about, is it's become clear that simply because you own the property and give it legal protection, that your biological features could still degrade. So, for example, you know, if you have a prairie, the climate here is such that if you didn't burn it, it would grow into eventually woods, and you'd lose your prairie. There's exotic species, things like garlic mustard in woods or purple loosestrife in wetlands. The forests themselves, I mean, at least along the edges, were subjected to fire in time past. So there's changes. Now, change is unavoidable, but we try to, land managers try to kind of direct the change and in order to keep the maximum diversity. So while the forests were under legal protection for a long time, they probably were ignored for a while, and some of these other, effects were going on, and probably that's been more recent that people have started being concerned that some of these forests are changing in ways that some people don't want. So it's sort of a two-part. Yeah, yes, there's more forests, but some of the forests are doing fine, and others are, doing less well and require more human intervention.
Yeah. The oak forest, apparently under pressure from the maple, is that in fact the case, and why is that the case?
Well, I mean, it depends. What I wrote, that was a very hard section to write because people had such differing opinions about it. There are places where oaks are doing fine, and there are other places where, particularly in wetter places, where maples seem to be taking over. And the fact that they're taking over, is that necessarily a bad thing? Oaks, so if things are burned on a regular basis, that's going to favor oaks. There's a number of reasons. Oaks, acorns really can't travel very far. rely sometimes on birds doing it, whereas, maple, samaras, those little boomerang-shaped leaves, they travel. So, they're able to colonize. Maples might also be cyclical, but there are certain years where certain species of oaks produce very little in the way of acorns. There's issues. Deer, are quite, are certainly more abundant than the area can sustain. They can decimate, eat acorns. There's a lot of factors, and some of it, fire is one issue, and so these changes, some more natural, some less so, and there does seem to be in a lot of these woods this change going on, and that's, as I say, that's a challenge. And I, one of the things I wanted to emphasize, and this was maybe one of the less politically correct things, is that nature's really complex, and that a lot of what goes on is gray. It's not black and it's not white. And when people tend to get involved, be it for good causes or not, they tend to see what they're looking for. And I think that that was sort of why I titled that "Do Go Gentle." Because I think it's important the other thing to keep in mind is any change you make. If you go in and you say, okay, we want to help oaks, so we're going to sort of trim out some of the maples or just sort of open up the woods a bit, well, you're going to benefit some things, but you're going to hurt others, and you have to be cognizant of that. It's not just one way. You take a drug and may cure your headache, but you get a stomach ache. So, you have to balance those things, and I think it's important to keep that in mind.
Yeah, that's a really useful metaphor, I think. The possible side effects, hair loss, upset stomach. If you think of it that way, it suddenly rings loud and clear how complex nature is and how everything is interconnected.
Well, a good example, in the Great Lakes, people are, several years ago, people were concerned water levels were high and some of the condos on Lakeshore Drive might fall into the lake, which some of us maybe were rooting for, but nonetheless, now the levels have dropped and people are worried, well, with lower levels on the Great Lakes, it's increased potential habitat for piping plover, which is this little sandpiper that's federally endangered in the Great Lakes, but it nests only on beaches. So the more beaches there are, the greater chances it has to survive. So it's as they say, it's kind of mixed. And that's, you know, under a natural regime without people, without modern people changing the landscape like it was, you know, there were all kinds of little niches, and something lived in all of them. And so that's a danger too, is that as we manage the land, I mean, even, you know, you manage it in a certain way, well, you may be foreclosing opportunities for something you haven't even thought about. Burning prairies, it's no question it's an essential part of prairie management, or we would lose our prairies. But there's sort of mixed evidence as to what impact it has on some insects. And, you know, some research suggests that most insects it doesn't affect. But let's say it affects a few. Well, you know, I mean, we would presumably want to keep those insects too. So it suggests that you have to be real, real careful, maybe try to come up with other techniques. And then it becomes more expensive. And from an institutional standpoint, you know, just bring in bison to do some grazing, and then you have to put up fencing. I mean, it just, trying to replicate the full diversity of nature is really, really hard.
Yeah. I know that there's a lot of efforts on underway in terms of reconstruction, but it is so complex.
Well, and that's something too. You have to make a distinction, and you're talking about like reconstruction. There are people that, I mean, it's kind of artificial prairies. I mean, the biggest one is one that, and one of the best is at Fermilab in the West DuPage County that Dr. Betts was involved with. But what you have to keep in mind, as nice as these are, and they're certainly worthwhile and good things, you know, they, 20 years, 30 years, as opposed to Markham Prairie, which was developing since maybe the ice disappeared. I mean, for thousands of years. And so we have to keep the time scales in mind that, you know, there's some of these forces that, you know, we humans tend to think in terms of years, you know, budgets or even careers, whereas, you know, some of these natural cycles are much, much longer than that.
Yeah. Before we have to say goodbye this afternoon, talk with us a little bit about Lake Michigan. This is one of the gems of the Chicago region. What would you like to say about Lake Michigan?
Oh, boy. Well, I think of Lake Michigan as sort of the last real wilderness around here. I mean, you know, it's not hospitable to humans, and if you go in there unprepared, you'll die. But in terms of what lives there, one of the important things is that the biggest threat, I think it's generally agreed, to life in Lake Michigan are exotic species. And, you know, in the 30s and 40s, two species came in to the Great Lakes from the Atlantic Ocean, and they had been kept out previously by Niagara Falls. I mean, it's just not possible for something to go up the falls. But once they built canals to circumvent the falls to allow trade, lampreys and, sea lampreys, because there are some native lampreys, but sea lampreys and alewives were able to enter the lakes above Lake Ontario, which does have a natural opening with the Atlantic Ocean. Well, those two species just decimated native fish. The lamprey probably close to single-handedly, maybe with some help from overfishing, wiped out lake trout, say, in Lake Michigan. And we keep finding, so they've been around for a while. Then the zebra mussel came in from the bilge of boats. They discharge their water, and zebra mussels filter anything below a certain size. I don't know how often you go up to Chicago, Celeste. You know, several years ago, you'd look out years ago, and it was kind of a greenish color, and I've had people say, oh, look how clean Lake Michigan is now. It's blue. Well, that's because the plankton, all these little floating animals and plants that are the basis of the ecosystem, are gone because of the zebra mussel. So water clarity is much greater, which, here's a perfect example. I mean, it's wiped out a whole group, really, of animals or harm them, but there's more light penetrating, so we have more more plants growing up along the edges. I mean, so there's probably more bass and whatnot, but things like perch, I mean, there's no longer a commercial season on perch in Lake Michigan. So a lot of these fish that were really a traditional part, culturally as well, have been severely harmed. And now we have concern about these big-headed carp, which are coming up from the Illinois River, moving towards the lake. And again, I mean, years ago, there was no connection between the Illinois system and Lake Michigan, but in 1900, we started with these canals. And so they're able to get into places they never were before. They also feed on plankton, so, and compete with things like perch. So the fear is if these guys get into the lake, that would be just one more stress on an already somewhat precarious ecosystem. So as one person told me, one scientist, the history of Lake Michigan is really a history of introduced species. So that may be the most important concern. I mean, there still are pollution and other human kinds of concerns, but you know, I think these biological visitors are the ones that most people are concerned about.
Yeah. Well, they don't just visit; they take up residence.
They absolutely. Yeah, that was maybe the wrong permanent residence.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Joel Greenberg, thank you so much for talking with me this afternoon. I really enjoyed it.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
Joel Greenberg has been our guest this afternoon in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. He is the author of A Natural History of the Chicago Region. The book is published by the University of Chicago Press. 8 minutes before 2 o'clock, settlement prices are in from the Chicago Board of Trade. Here with the numbers today, Jay Pierce.
Thank you very much, Celeste. September wheat had a high of 336.5, a low of 332.5, settled at 333 today, up 2.5. The December contract had a high of 350.5, a low of 346.5, settled at 347, up 1.75. March 06 wheat had a high of 362.5, a low of 359, settled at 359.5, up 1.5. And the July 06 wheat contract had a high of 371.5, a low of 368, settled at 368, up 2.25. On to the corn pits, September, the high today, 241.5, the low, 239.25, settled at 241, up 4.5. December corn had a high of 252.75, a low of 250.25, settled at 252.5, up 4.75. March corn, the high today, 260, low 257.5, settled at 259.5, up 4.25. May 06, the high today, 263.75, the low 262.25, settled at 263.5, up 4. July 06 corn, 268, the high, 265.5, the low, settled at 267.5, up 4. And September 06 corn, at a high of 252, make that 262.5, a low of 261.5, settled there, 261.5, up 1. September oats, the high 169, the low 167.5, settled at 168.5, up 1. And December oats at 173.5 for the high, 172.5 for the low, 173.25 the settlement, up 1.5. Now on to the soybeans. August, 690 for the high, 680.5 was the low, 684.25 was the settlement, up 10.5. September soybeans had a high of 695, a low of 685.5, the settlement 689, up 11. November, the high, 704, the low, 694, the settlement 698.25, up 11.75. January, the high 706, the low 698, the settlement 701.75, up 12.75. March 06 soybeans, the high today $7.50, the low 693.5, settlement at 697.25, up 10.75. May, the high 690, low 686, settlement 689, up 10.5. And July 06 soybeans, the high 690, the low 686, settlement 686.5, up 8.5. August soybean meal had a high of 218.50, a low of 215.20, the settlement 215.80, up 230. September, the high 217.50, the low 214.30, the settlement 215.10, up 250. And the August soybean oil had a high of 24.72, a low of 24.40, the sentiment 24.50, up 19. September also winding up 19. 24.81 was the high, 24.48 the low, 24.58 the sentiment, and again that up 19. And now let's go back to Celeste for a look at how things wrapped up on the Mercantile Exchange.
Okay, prices largely higher today, mostly higher today on the Merc. August feeder cattle, 107.65 the high, the low 106.72.5. The settlement, 107.57.5, that up 45. September, 106.05, the high 105.25, the low, the settlement, 105.82.5. That up 15. October, 105.15, the high, the low 104.40, the settlement 105.02.5, that up 5. August live cattle, 79.75, the high 78.92.5, the low, the settlement 79.57.5, that up 22.5. October live cattle, 82.15, the high 81.10, the low, the settlement 82.05, that up 67.5. August lean hog, 67.65, the high 67.05, the low 67.27.5, the settlement, that down 22.5. October 57.45, the high 56.55, the low 56.85, the settlement, that up 22.5. December 55.60, the high 54.85, the low, the settlement 55.07.5, that down 12.5, and February lean hogs 58.20, the high, the low 57.50, the settlement 57.95, that up 7.5. And August bellies, the high today 79.95, the low 78.67.5, the settlement today for August bellies 79.20, that up 1.25. And now let's check on the Dow. It's up 69 points at 10,706. The NASDAQ is up 12 at 2198. And the S&P 500, 8 higher at 1245.
Agricultural programming on WILL is made possible by Farm Credit Services of Illinois. Farm Credit Services of Illinois has been providing for farmers' credit and insurance needs for over 85 years, including real estate, operating and machinery loans, crop and life insurance protection, and programs for young and beginning farmers.
It's time once again to Ask Dr. Science. So let's ask Dr. Science.
That's me.
Remember, he knows more than you do.
That's right.
Dorothy Chandler from Madison, Wisconsin writes, Dear Dr. Science, where did barn swallows live before people had barns?
They lived in motels and were referred to quite naturally as motel swallows. A lot of what goes on in your average motel is hard to swallow, but that never stopped the aggressive little birds who didn't care where they parked their feathers as long as they had cable TV and an ice machine nearby. Incidentally, a century ago, before the hotel gave way to the motel, these birds were called flying rats and were thought to spread rabies. This reputation was merely a 19th century overreaction to hedonistic and self-centered lifestyles, but nowadays such behavior is the norm. But back on the farm, well, it would have been appropriate only in the barn.
Thank you, Dr. Science.